This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. My co-host Craig Blumenschein is on vacation. Coming up in the second half of today's show, eating hyper-local and producing as little waste as possible, even when it comes to fossil fuels. But we are going to start today with a different conversation about food and the impacts on our mental health. Studies show that a diet high in refined sugars can impair brain function and worsen symptoms of mood disorders such as depression. That can also lead to oxidative stress, which is an imbalance between free radicals and antioxidants in your body, which can sometimes manifest as fatigue, muscle or joint pain, and even gray hair. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and today we are looking back on an interview from 2021 as we talk about the difference between having a diet and being on a diet, and other ways to incorporate mindful, healthful eating, and the impacts on both our mental and physical health. The Mediterranean diet is one of the most healthful, delicious ways of eating on the planet, but we don't live near the Mediterranean. Can we apply the dietary principles here in the Great Plains and the Midwest? In a conversation that first aired in 2021, we learn about the book Midwest Mediterranean, Finding Health and Flavor with the Foods of the North, and it features contributions from people with PhDs, sixth-generation farmers, medical doctors, registered dietitians, and we are visiting with two of the contributors to this book, registered dietitian Meg Myrdal. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ashley.
And one of those people with one of those PhDs, Peter Schultz. Thank you for joining us today. I want to start with you, Peter, because early on in the book, you talk about the word diet as not something that you just go on. It's not really a verb. It's a noun. And more than that, it's a lifestyle.
That's right. That's right. That was one of the things that we talked about earlier when we first started working on this project, is that this is way more than about food.
Yeah.
There is a kind of holistic message that weaves its way through this entire project. And what it's really about is healthy bodies, but it's also about healthy minds and healthy souls, really, if you can say that. The ancient Greek word for diet, dieta, means sort of a way of being, in essence. Mm-hmm. So when you say you're going on a diet, that is certainly one aspect of that way of being. But for an ancient Mediterranean, they would understand that this was going to encompass your whole essence. And I think that's what we're after in the project.
Yeah, because Megan, you have been active in local food for as long as I've known you, and one of the founders of Food of the North, formerly Ugly Food of the North, a movement to get people to realize that an apple doesn't have to be shiny and perfect to be edible. And the aspect that you bring to the book is this idea that we can take something well established, like a thousands-year-old diet, and infuse it with local flavors. How did you get involved in this project?
I've been active and working in the local food space for most of my career, really focused on North Dakota and the foods that are grown in our region of the world. Peter, I knew him from my days at Concordia when he was a professor there and I was a student. And Peter has been importing this fantastic olive oil from Greece for many years into our community, which is also a big component of this book. And I was working on farmers market development and working with local community gardeners and really trying to get folks in our place in the world to celebrate the foods that we grow here and showing different ways that they can be cooked and prepared and hosting awesome markets where these farmers get to share their food and showcase their awesome goods. And so we got on this conversation and he's like, you know, I've got this really amazing olive oil. I'd love to see it paired with some of those foods that are grown in the upper Midwest. And so we worked together to make a dish that we called the Midwest Mediterranean bean salad. It's filled with all the local seasonal vegetables that we grow here, tomatoes, tomatoes, cucumbers, kale, onions, things that are just kind of the staples of our garden. It has dryable beans, which we are the top producing region in the country for dryable beans, pinto beans, kidney beans, navy beans, all of those awesome plant-based proteins. And then we made a delicious vinaigrette that uses the olive oil and balsamic and feta cheese and olives and some of those signature Mediterranean flavors. It's not a complicated salad at all, right? Like, this is a very simple dish. It can be made easily by anybody in their home kitchen, but it tastes so good. And this isn't revolutionary. This isn't anything that we're bringing any profound ideas here, but just kind of articulating that we can take the foods that are grown here and combine them with these techniques and ingredients in the Mediterranean and make something that is so good for our bodies and so good for our communities. And it tastes really delicious too. And then we just like had this little epiphany kind of, and we were both eating the salad and got super excited. And I mean, how often do people get really excited when they're eating beans? But we did. And then we like embarked on this like journey of creating this book. 2 years later, here we are. Midwest Mediterranean is out. You mentioned that we have all these other contributing authors. It's just super fun, and it's been such a gratifying experience to pull together all these awesome people in our community to connect with people over in the Mediterranean. The ideas are holistic, but the process has been really holistic too, which has been super cool.
Yeah, Peter, you have studied in Greece. You have taught this lifestyle. You have been living this. What first got you interested in that part of the world and this desire to bring it over here to meat and potatoes country?
Sure. Well, that is an enormous question.
Yeah, sure.
I'm going to drill down on the food piece.
Okay.
When I lived in Greece for almost a decade, I kind of became a Mediterranean diet addict by default. I didn't know what was really happening to me because that was just the cuisine. But when I came back to the States and started hanging out with incredible local food folks, it became really clear that many of the values, especially about community and togetherness and interconnectivity, are completely the same. Hmm. The Greeks and the folks of the High Plains share way more in common than you might think. And one of the things that's been exciting about this project in that regard is seeing this kind of blending that Megan is talking about, where you will have literally a local cardiologist from Fargo with a recipe right next to a chef from Crete. And they actually are speaking the exact same language. Mm. So for me, it was sort of a basic acculturation at first that sort of translated into bridge building and probably most importantly, just having a really good time.
Well, so often with food programs, you get these ultra high-end chefs and ingredients and things that look amazing, but they cost a fortune to make. And there is a role to high quality ingredients and starting with those because oftentimes they're expensive because they are the healthiest, the purest, the best tasting. But then we start to go on this level, Megan, of trying to make these recipes accessible. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really where this book comes together.
100%. If you look at kind of the concepts that we're talking about and then the recipes that are included in this book, I will say that there are a couple things. Our wonderful cardiologist that contributed a recipe for a lobster dish, which, I mean, that's a special sometimes option. But a lot of them are grain-based salads that are featuring beans. Beans are cheap. Whole grains are cheap. And that's where, like, I really got excited about this idea is because beans and grains are two things that we grow in incredible abundance in this place of the world, and they are highly affordable things. So if you base a lot of meals on beans and greens, those are two awesome, nutritious ingredients that together they make a complete protein. So you don't have to maybe buy some of those more expensive animal cuts of meat. And then like some of those really, really high quality ingredients that do cost a little bit more that are going to really provide that highly nutritional product as well as something that is going to make the food taste super good, like that really high quality extra virgin olive oil, it leaves space in your food budget to allow for some of those more expensive ingredients.
So what's going on with that high quality extra virgin olive oil?
Right.
Why the splurge there?
Well, I think that's a place where if you want to choose a staple for this kind of diet, that's where you want your dollars to go if you have the extra to spend. Ashley, there is this rampant fraud in the world of olive oil.
Yeah.
And there was this famous study that came out from University of California at Davis where they're like, yep, it looks like about 80% of everything labeled extra virgin olive oil on your grocery shelves is actually not. And that has real consequences, not just for our farmers, but for you and for your health. Because it is garbage in, garbage out. If you really want to take care of yourself, you have to know, you know, what you're eating, obviously. Mm-hmm. And in this case, if you are consuming as what you think to be your healthy fat, something that's actually loaded with chemicals or dyes or blends or something else that you're not even quite sure of, you are actually going backwards in terms of what the diet is about. When it comes to olive oil, knowing who makes your food and being willing to actually have a conversation with these folks who are producing this nutrition and sustenance for you is key. You know, the stuff I bring in, Ashley, it is a little bit more expensive than what you'll find in the grocery store, but I have seen similar quality stuff in Greece, in California, New York for $60 a bottle, right? And we're talking about $13 a bottle. So yeah, it is on the high end for sort of what you might find in a Costco or sort of whatnot, but you know where it's coming from, you know who grew it, and you know that these people are taking care of their land, and most importantly, they're taking care of you.
What is the difference between a whole grain and what is a lot more likely that we're eating around here, Megan?
We live in the breadbasket of America, right? We live in a place that produces an abundance of grains, wheat, barley, oats. But probably 95, if not more, percent of the grains in which people are eating are a processed grain. And so if you think about that whole intact grain, you have a bran, a germ, and an endosperm. Those are the three components that make up most grains. When they process those grains, they remove the bran and the germ, which are two highly nutritious components of that grain. They can obtain a lot of the nutrients and a lot of the fiber. And then they mill it down and create different flours that are used in all of the different baked goods that we're eating, our breads, our pastas, a lot of the cakes and cookies and all of those things. And when you process that grain, one, I already mentioned, you're removing a lot of that high nutritional quality, but you're also reducing the amount of work the body has to do to break down that grain. And if we really think about it, like one of the big tenets of the Mediterranean diet is eating as much whole, unprocessed, plant-based food as we can. And so having those grains in that whole intact form, and when I've been mentioning these dishes that are based on beans and grains, one of my absolute favorite things to make for a dish is a whole grain salad, cooking up farro or barley or wheat berries and having that as a cold grain and mixing that into a salad instead of having the hot dishes and the pasta salads that we eat so much in this place in the world. Can we do more salads with those whole grains? Diabetes and chronic diseases are two conditions that are running rampant across the country. And one of the things that I talk about in my chapter of the book and our cardiologists and our gastroenterologists talk about as well is that we have some pretty significant health issues here. We have really high rates of overweight and obesity. We have high rates of chronic disease, diabetes, cancers, heart diseases. And we really live in a state with the diets that people are eating where our bodies are chronically inflamed. We have our blood sugars are out of control. We're eating foods that are just not treating our bodies well. And these whole grains, the way in which they digest in the body, they cause a much slower blood sugar response that keeps our immune systems in check. It keeps our blood sugars in check. It's the way in which we were intended to eat those foods. The body is eating it in the form in which it is meant to do the work, to break it down slowly, to provide that slow release of energy that is going to nourish the body and keep all those metabolic systems in check. So that's really one of the big things that I try to stress in this book is that we really need to rethink grains and get people more on this whole grain message.
And additionally, just the impact of the health of the gut on the health of the rest of the person, talking about this holistic approach to living, how is it that we can have a mental health component that is directly related to our gut health?
We're really lucky that we had a mental health practitioner who was involved in writing this book and wrote a couple of awesome chapters, or excuse me, one chapter that talks about that mind-body connection and mind-diet connection, as well as our gastroenterologist, because you bring up the gut health piece of it too. So There's been an overwhelming amount of research that has come out in the last 10 years about this gut-brain connection, and that people had often thought that all the decision-making that happens and how we feel and how we interpret the world around us is related to the health of our brains. But there's actually the second brain that resides in our gut. And we are actually, as humans, we are actually more microbe than we are human. There are more, which kind of freaks people out a little bit, but there are more microorganisms living in our body, the majority of which are residing in our gut as well as on our skin, actually all over our bodies. And the way that we eat has a profound impact on the health of those microbes and which ones live within our bodies too. And I know you know this very, very well, Ashley, through your work with the gut microbiome and your family's business. But it is really fascinating. And the diet in which we eat, the majority of in this country, the standard American diet or the SAD diet, as it's sometimes referred to, with those processed grains, the sugar-sweetened beverages, just not eating a diet that is providing that collection of organisms that live within our bodies, the nutrition that they need, it is impacting our health in so many different ways. And one of those is a mental health piece. Mm-hmm. And I think that is, I think the whole book is very interesting, but the mental health piece is just fascinating. We live in a country that is just rampant with mental health issues. And to not saying that this is the end all cure all, but we know that people's physical health is impacting their mental health. I mean, that is a well understood thing. So if you are walking around inflamed with a misbalanced gut microbiome and mm-hmm. undiagnosed diabetes, of course that is impacting your mental health and well-being. And diet plays such a profound role in that. So it's really exciting to think about this book with hopefully all the different messages that are shared in that if heart disease isn't your biggest concern, but you might be thinking, you know, maybe the mental health piece is something that will motivate people. Or maybe it's wanting to connect and support a farmer in Greece or support a farmer here. And that's when we talk about this word holistic, I feel like it comes in so many different ways of how we think about this mm-hmm. book. And that's one thing that that I hope that this book does too, is that you find a reason to get excited about eating this way for your own well-being as well as the well-being of others.
I want to go back to that holistic approach. After I graduated college, I had a job in France, and I was able to move overseas. And I remember knowing that it was an amazing opportunity, but also I used to get so bored on my two-hour lunch break because all the businesses were closed. Everybody had this two-hour lunch break, mm-hmm. and I was used to, you know, since kindergarten having 20 minutes to eat mm-hmm. lunch and recess, and so you have a mm-hmm. vested interest in eating quickly so that you could maximize, you know, fun. But if you could just talk, Peter, about the difference in the approach to meal time
sure.
between what you saw here and in the decade that you were living in Greece.
Sure, sure. Well, that's a great question. I think that especially in the around the Mediterranean basin, things slow down a little bit. There's kind of an expectation that, you know, it's going to be a long lunch one way or another. And dinners, I mean, I remember sitting down at 10 o'clock and we didn't get up until 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, wow. They just kind of roll on. And there is something to be said, I think, for a gathering where you are really engaged with your friends or family that doesn't really seem to have an end. There's no pressure to go out to recess. There's no pressure to worry about really tomorrow in that moment. It's a very different kind of mentality. It's like, you know, let's savor this right now. Mm. Like right now, hanging out with Megan and you, Ashley, you know, let's take a little time here. It's nice. I know we only have limited time, but the idea that there always have to be deadlines is itself a cultural construct that we have sort of locked ourselves into or maybe bought into mm-hmm. That does not have to be the case. And we know that because there is a whole massive population that is not living like that. And it just turns out they're living really long lives and they are profoundly happy on various indices. And they're operating and eating in a way that goes back for millennia. So maybe it's worth thinking about doing it super old school and just mm-hmm. slowing it down a bit.
Megan, you often call yourself a farmer's daughter. Your people are of the land. They've worked the land. But we have this stereotype for better or for worse, of farmers being stubborn and the approach to food just being, like I said earlier, the meat and potatoes. And I'm wondering, how accurate do you think that really is?
You know, I think that we are in a time when people are becoming much, much more enlightened to the idea of the profound impact food has on health, and we are becoming a more health-minded consumer. The farmer in rural America, I do agree that there might be some barriers to overcome. As Peter was talking about the dinner that goes until 3 a.m., and I'm thinking about my very, like, German father, who is, like, the most time pressed man ever and just likes everything to be.
That's about when he probably has to get up to work.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, that's probably not going to appeal to him. Maybe I can get him to eat a bean salad, but I'm probably not going to get him to like drink wine with me and toast till 3 a.m. But I think that there is the world of food is changing so much. People are becoming so much more aware of these global flavors, global food. People are excited by food. They think of it as a way to adventure and learn something new. I think that generationally it is changing a lot too. I would love to see some folks that are, you know, like the 65-year-old farmer Harold that is pretty established in his cereal, orange juice, and milk every morning. Sorry, Dad. maybe consider some more of these whole plant-based ingredients. He does eat very well, so I need to say that too for the most part. But I think that we have a lot of opportunity with younger generations, too, to be young people are really interested in food. We have a lot of opportunity to get folks excited about this. And you know, I've read a number of things that younger children have a pretty profound impact on their parents, too. So if they're interested in health and well-being and they're trying these new things and they bring it to their parents and get them excited about it and show them, people are motivated by so many things to live longer and healthier. Parents, grandparents that want to be there for their grandkids. They want to be active and healthy much more than generations before. So I think that this is an interesting time when some of these stereotypes that we've had in the past around the farmer from rural North Dakota that is not interested in changing, I think that we could be at a unique point right now where people are open to some change. And then again, I will just say this, like, I know I talk the health piece of a lot, but just the food tastes so good. Like, I would say, this might be a little too confident, but I'm like, put some of these dishes up against your steak and potatoes. And I mean, I love steak and potatoes every now and again, too. I'm not saying don't eat that. And we talk about, like, potatoes are awesome. Red meat is kind of a sticky wicket on this subject, but you can have some of those foods as well. But this food tastes super, super good. Just try it, and you could be you'd be very surprised.
The book is called Midwest Mediterranean, Finding Health and Flavor with the Foods of the North. There are chapters from a cardiologist, a psychotherapist, an archaeologist, a dietitian, a farmer, and then there are recipes like the summer chickpea salad, oat groats with crispy kale, wild mushrooms, and caper butter, the famous Mediterranean beet salad. We have spicy potatoes and so much more, and it is available through Theron Press. Megan Myrdal is the founder of Food of the North and a dietitian. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Ashley.
Peter Schultz is an archaeologist, an academic, and an olive oil importer. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Ashley.
That conversation first aired in September 2021. Still to come on Main Street, a polar explorer and his cookbook.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. The question, why, is very empowering. It's about the divine, it's about the moral, it's about the pleasurable, it's about fear. Why is everything? I'm not very good with authority, and I'm not very good with limits, and so I like a question that gives me the ability to do whatever I want, whenever I want. I was born and raised in Manhattan, on the edge of a neighborhood that most people would know as Spanish Harlem. I ended up in North Dakota because they offered me a job. It's that simple, and we've had a very good life here so far. Dispel these myths. Philosophy is boring. I guess I would ask you to ask yourself, are you boring? Do you think you have nothing of interest to offer anybody? You are philosophy. Philosophy is you. Everything you ask, everything you think, everything you want, everything you strive for, this is what makes up philosophy. Philosophy itself is compelling enough and exciting enough that it is pretty much the oldest discipline. And philosophers had more influence on the world than almost anybody. Plato, Aristotle, we live in their world. And so if you want to make philosophy exciting, you have to be exciting. Philosophy majors can't get jobs or make any money. Philosophy is the highest paid major of all of the humanities, and the rate of return is actually the same over a lifetime as engineering. Listen to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life every second Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain on Prairie Public.
And we're back on Main Street. I'm Ashley Thornburg, continuing our theme today, exploring mental health through the lens of food. In the first half, we were really focusing on the food that we're eating and its impact on both our physical and mental health. In the second half, we're going to focus in on how our food choices impact the health of the environment. Psychology.org cites air pollution as a major environmental health risk. Some of the impacts are more physical on things like respiratory diseases, but there is a growing body of research out there about air pollution and psychological distress and the impacts on depression. Today, we are looking back on a conversation that first aired in April of 2022 with famed polar explorer Will Steiger and his niece, Rita May, who worked on the cookbook, The Steiger Homestead Kitchen, Simple Recipes for an Abundant Life. This book promotes seasonal eating, foraging, and producing no waste and using no fossil fuels. Why did you want to put out a cookbook?
I explore, but I also, we've been working on the Steiger Wilderness Center. It's a convening center for people, and it's also a place for sustainability and to learn trades. So we feed a lot of people during the summer months. We have an average of about 30 people there, and then Rita May is our main chef. And we felt it would be best to get a cookbook out, and which is about a healthy body and a healthy planet.
Well, I have already made two recipes out of this cookbook, and just a couple recipes here. Fire pit roast chicken, Northwoods mushroom wild rice soup, the Rita Mae Rubin mom's favorite hot dish, fire roasted baba ganoush, and of course, red flannel hash. I mean, you are in northern Minnesota at this Steiger Wilderness Center. Rita Mae, what was your approach for choosing what recipes really reflect what the Wilderness Center is all about?
I definitely wanted to make sure that there were a lot of like vegetable forward recipes. We divided the book into sections of just like comfort food, food for like a big gathering, and things from the garden. And so I just kind of made sure there were enough things for each category. But also I based it off of what I cook up at the homestead every day. So these are all recipes that I've made multiple times and that I've really enjoyed serving for other people.
And when you say recipes that you made, I mean, from scratch hardly even seems like the right word, because there's so many layers of, you know, sometimes you're foraging these mushrooms. But then this is also, Will, a major component of the Steiger Wilderness Center is, of course, that sustainability. You're not even using fossil fuels in your kitchen. Will, describe what the Wilderness Center is like, and then Rita, I'll have you elaborate on specifically the kitchen.
When I first moved up 50 years ago, we were off the road. We were 3 miles from the nearest road, so it was a real wilderness setting. I had dogs at that time to bring people in and out and all of our supplies, and we put the road in about 25 years in order to build the main center. So it's an extended community where, especially in the summertime, a lot of people gather, and we do courses there in sustainability. But since early on, you know, we raised, in the 70s, 80s, we raised most of our own food. Our refrigeration is we cut ice from the lake. In fact, 2 weekends ago, we cut ice, put it in our ice house, and that serves as refrigeration along with root cellars. So for the last 50 years, we haven't used any fossil fuels at all. And then again, of course, our food is what we can forage and grow, but the rest is mainly local. And in eating this way and also buying in bulk to save money, and organic, you really reduce your carbon or your carbon footprint, but in particular your garbage stream. We were this idea of the center was actually birthed about 4 years ago when I teach at the Dunwoody School of Architecture here in Minneapolis, and we were designing the new dining hall, which will be up and running about 3 years from now. And at that point, I decided to do this cookbook, first of all, as a way of managing the waste stream, because having 50 people there eating, you're going to generate a lot of waste. But when you're buying and foraging, and what we emphasize here in the book, you really cut your waste stream down, which is very important here for the climate.
And Rita Mae, the kitchen specifically, what's it like there?
The kitchen is in our lodge. It's a really old cabin. The kitchen's also old, but I do my best to make things on my own to reduce waste. So I'll make my own nut milks or yogurt, my own crackers. I spend a lot of time and put a lot of thought into how I can use less waste as possible.
And how does that impact when you sit down to enjoy a meal? You know, if you are making your own sometimes flour, or, you know, gathering the mushrooms and making the milk that goes into the cake or on the oatmeal or what have you, how does that change how you eat the food?
I think that at least people eating my food up there, a lot of them come up from the cities, and I think there's just like a different kind of energy that the food gives you, and just the way it is presented.
What is the role of livestock on the grounds, Will?
Yeah, we don't there. We don't have chickens or livestock there. We do fish but we buy our meats are more local. It's from local farmers. In fact, some of the pork that we buy, we know the farms that it comes from. Sometimes even know what pigs it comes from. But these are family farms. And they're pasture-raised, and pasture-raised meat is really one of the solutions for climate change, because with the hoofs and that, they dig up the soil and manure, and it creates a really rich pasture and grasses, which actually sequesters them carbon dioxide. But then the food itself is organic and very healthy for you. We don't aspire to any type of corporate farm food like meat or corn. Mm. It's all local, and it's always from local farms. It's all about good taste. I mean, some people think that if you're living in a simple way or eating simple, that you're compromising something. But it's just the opposite. The value of simplicity, especially in simplicity in cooking, is really a value added. It's really a higher quality food. It tastes so much better. It's so much more varied. And then at the center, we all work a long day there. So. You know, it serves to really give our bodies nutrients, feeling good. Your body recovers over the evening, and that. So it's a real, real important way to, and the important way of eating in the future, too, is a sustainable way like this.
There really is something magical that happens when you cook food over, for example, a fire pit. Rita Mae, talk about your recipe, fire pit roast chicken. As I was flipping through the book, and one of the pictures is all of these chickens hanging from a string.
Yeah, that's always fun. It's always a group effort whenever we cook around the fire. Usually there's a big gathering, and everyone gets to help out in some way by carrying the chickens down and tying them up and watching them cook over the lake.
Now, the cookbook, again, it's called The Steger Homestead Kitchen, Simple Recipes for an Abundant Life. And I want to focus in on that word homestead, because, Will, early on in the book, you say homesteading is not about taming the wilderness. It's about garnering resources. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Yeah, I use the word homesteading because 50 years ago, I was raised in the city. In 1970, I moved to the wilderness. I bought this land when I was 19 in 1964. And all my life, ever since I was a child, I wanted to homestead. In other words, I wanted to be self-sufficient. I wanted to clear land with my hands, raise my own food, make my own cabin and furniture and so forth and the local materials and the stone. So homestead to me is about being self-sufficient. In this day, we're calling it sustainability. But it's being that really close to your food stream. And we're not all able to have our own land that we can clear. And we might, if we're fortunate, to have gardens in a backyard. But especially in the Midwest, we're always very close to sources of really great food. And also sources of, when we're sourcing out food, I always look at climate change above all, but also about creating a new economy, a new self-sufficient, self-reliant, sustainable economy where you're supporting your local industries and living that way.
So are other groups of people ever coming to the Steger Center for education reasons, how to take this and apply it to somewhere else?
Yes, of course, when they're... a lot of people come through the center. Right now we're in the building construction mode, so we have a lot of master builders and students, apprentices and masters. Mm. We do education, and also we're starting now with our main goal here is the leadership. But it's all about living closer to your food, and for some people it's the first time they've ever seen a loaf of bread made from scratch, where they're actually grinding up the flour. It really shows the possibilities. The quality possibilities of our future life, that we have to live this type of life here if we're going to be sustainable and live on this planet without it just totally disappearing on us.
Rita May, for anybody who might be kind of a beginner to this, it can be so easy to think, well, it's frozen here months and months at a time. Can there really be enough food? What are some of your favorite things that we have forgotten are food?
Yeah, in the wintertime, I always save vegetable scraps. I mean, even in the summertime, to make vegetable stock with. Everything from like the ends of mushrooms to like onion skin and garlic skin, I'll just throw that all in the pot. At the homestead, we have a lot of purslane growing everywhere, so I'll harvest the young purslane and just saute it in some garlic.
And people think that's a weed.
Yeah. Same with dandelion.
You know, and your question there too, in the wintertime, a lot about eating, especially in the northern climates, is about storage.
Yes.
You know, we have our up there, we have ice, our ice boxes. We harvest ice. We have a root cellar, which serves as a refrigerator. And we have pantries. We do a lot of dry storage. Lots of our grain. We purchase the grain. It's all organic. That can last for years and years. What we harvest, we dry. A lot of it we freeze. Some of it we can. And a lot of it we store in the root cellar. So if you go in our root cellar right now, you'll see apples, carrots and so forth that was harvested from last year. So storage is a really important part of the pantry, because in the north we have a growing season maybe 6 months, and then the rest other 6 months here we have to take, you know, look at storing foods, which is a very important part of what we do at the homestead.
Yeah, especially if you're not using fossil fuels here. You touched on this briefly, Will, but the process of harvesting ice. How do you go about collecting ice that can refrigerate food for long periods of time?
So we usually cut ice the first week of February. We had four horses that come up that we haul it with. It's a local event. We probably had about 50 people that come out. We saw it's labor intensive, but we cut enough ice for the whole year. We bring it then with horses from the lake to the ice cellar, and the ice cellar is like underground, like a cellar, an underground room, and we put it in. The cellar, we pack it in around sawdust, so we have a triple door system of getting in there. Wow. And that ice will hold up right up until the next winter. So when we cut ice that next year, we're throwing out ice from the last year's lake. And this is, by the way, 100 years ago or 80 years ago, that's all the refrigeration came from ice. So it isn't like we reinvented the wheel. We're just doing what was always done, is cutting ice like that.
Yeah. What have you seen over your time there? You said you moved out of the city and into the woods, I think you said in the 1970s. So you have had some time to notice these climate change shifts that are happening. Are you seeing dramatic changes, for example, in the levels of ice every year?
Yeah, we're seeing some. It's variable on the ice. What we are seeing is the later freeze-up. Mm. Our lake used to freeze around the 1st of November. Now it's maybe the 15th or 20th. And the springs are variable. I mean, it's this climate change. Sometimes we have ice on the opening fishing season in mid-May, and then sometimes it's open at the end of March. Mm. So you have these varying various seasons. But one thing that's real noticeable is the winter weather. You know, we really had severe winters back 70s and into the 80s, and now we don't see that. And but you know, when you're in one place like that, especially a great thing about gardening is you're in the moment all the time. You're out there harvesting. You're mm-hmm. watching the weather. A lot of times you're recording. You take a little journal of year to year what you planted, what worked, and so forth. But being outside and in that moment a lot and working with our food, you know, with that type of an intention, we're really good observers, and we also have a good intuitive ability that develops. And then that gives you a good sense of looking back. I mean, you can look back at your written records, but you can tell by gardening what's, you know, over a 10, 20-year period, how the season is changing. We used to have the early frosts in May or end of August, and we do get some early frosts, but the freeze up for sure, the first frosts are much later, sometimes even into October.
Hmm. What about on a more national level? You have been active in climate change work for decades. You founded the Climate Generation. Of course, you have traveled extensively across the polar regions of this planet by dog sled, sometimes doing live reports for national broadcasts. What kinds of trends are you seeing in terms of how seriously people are or are not still taking climate change?
Well, I've become an eyewitness to the changes in the polar regions. And I taught climate change in my classroom in the late 60s, so I've always, you know, paid attention to that. And so I've seen the changes in the Arctic. My first 25 years up there was the normal, really super cold. And then I was on the ice when it all changed. And in 1986, we did the first unsupported dog sled expedition to the pole. And now 35 years later, no one can do an expedition like that because of the open water. All the ice shelves I've traveled on, both the northern and southern hemisphere, have disintegrated. So I've seen massive changes. And then starting probably about 7 years ago, we started to see it in our own backyard. I mean, in Ely, we've had the fires, the droughts, you know, the floods. So it's pretty obvious what's happening. Not everybody, you know, believes in climate change. I mean, that's very unfortunate. But I think the majority of the people, you know, are seeing what's changing. And the seriousness of this is really really important. I mean, the climate is starting to go out of control. And that's a fact, and not to be scary or anything, but we have to take this very seriously. Denying is extremely irresponsible, and we're all entitled to our personal views and whatever we do want to believe in, but very important, I think, for a leadership level that we look at this. A great thing is the solutions to climate change or adaptation has to do with economics, of building the economy. So there's a real opportunities here for economically as we move forward. It's not the end of the road that way. Mm. But we have to really get back to a more of a sustainable living. Not everyone can grow their own food, but you have a lot of power in what you purchase, and you can support a lot of your local people and local farmers by making the proper choices like that. Sustainability means, you know, just it's a moral imperative, I think, for myself, and I think it's going to be that way for us. And like I said, you know, living sustainable is really a higher quality life. We're living in such a complex world. We're so divided as a country. Everyone is so frazzled, they don't even know what to do. And I think a good therapy for that is really maybe next spring to start a garden. And if you're in a community garden, and spend that time with your food, or spend time preparing your food if you've never done that before, with simple recipes, for example, maybe what Rita does in the cookbook. It's a really good way of first calming down and taking a time out on things, and then just taking a fresh look at the world around us here, that we need people that are, you know, really in common sense mode and can look at these solutions in a real practical way.
Rita Mae, you are at the Steger Wilderness Center seasonally. What's your kitchen setup like when you're not there?
You know, I'm pretty transient. My kitchen setup, I mean, right now I have two ovens in my kitchen at the homestead. The oven's very old. It's definitely more reliable here. But I live out of my van also for part of the year in California in the fall. And a lot of times I just cook on the camp stove or with my backpacking camp stove or over a fire with a cast iron.
Yeah, you have traveled pretty extensively. Your mother is Vietnamese. You've traveled around much of Asia. What is your approach to ethical, sustainable travel when it comes to, you know, the airport is, well, you can't really get around flying to Vietnam, for example.
I mean, wherever I travel to, I like to stay for a long time. I don't like to show up, be there for a week and leave. I really like to immerse myself and eat as much of the local food as possible.
Well, we have talked about fires a couple of times, but specific to cooking with fires, there is also just something so sacred, so elemental about sitting around a bonfire. What's the role of the bonfire at the Steger Center?
Well, it's a place of community. It's a place where we gather. And at the beginning, we make the bonfire. You know, in the early evening, we gather around food, and then everybody helps to clean up, and there's usually music, and it's real primordial, sitting around a fire, and the great conversations, everyone relaxes in the fire. You know, when we cut ice in February, you know, it's usually the coldest time of the year, we actually do a fire out there in the evening, and there's a choice of sitting inside where it's nice and warm around the wood stove, but almost everyone is out around the campfire, and we all relate to that. We naturally relax in front of a fire. It's the heat. It's the being mesmerized by that. But it's really the community that you're surrounding. The best of all friends come out. You know, the best of all people come out around a fire like that. And we don't have access to fire pits and fires like that enough. And which is real obvious. And on a real clear night, we're at the Steger Center. There, you can look up and you see the Milky Way and the stars. Sometimes the Northern Lights, and that around with the lake and the loons. And a fire and your good camaraderie, it re-grounds you in the universe.
Famed polar explorer Will Steger and chef Rita May of the Steger Center about the book, The Steger Homestead Kitchen, Simple Recipes for an Abundant Life. You can find out more at stegercenter.org. That conversation first aired in April 2022.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 5 is about tribal policies, treaties, and sovereignty. It states, Native people practice self-determination, developing tribal policies and practicing political activism. Despite a history of U.S. policies and treaties that have often been detrimental, Native people are members of sovereign nations that predate the U.S. government. In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to J.T. Shining Oneside, enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of the Chippewa Nation, in part one of A Native Perspective on Sovereignty.
They had true sovereignty because, you know, they had their tribal policies, you know, how the village would work together. And then they also had, everybody knew their place. Everybody had a place. And they all worked together. And it was all for the child, because it takes a village to raise a child. True sovereignty is when we really use the gifts in our village, in our tribal places, of our people, because we have basket makers, either birch bark or red willow. And we have our people that do bead work, quill work. We have artists, we have musicians, we have drummers, we have people that do hunting and trapping. All of these very, very different gifts that are there. And, you know, we also have education systems, judicial systems. We have all these different entities, but yet we're all the same people. And if we could learn to all work together to build and govern accordingly so that it's, you know, the system works for everybody. And Our dollars would stay, you know, they would fund their education, they would help fund the tribe, you know, all of these things. If they would work together, they would do that circle building, that nation building, and that would certainly be true sovereignty.
I'm Charla Stever. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous Elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org. Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street on tonight's Hidden Brain, the Eureka moment, how sometimes not focusing on an idea or a problem lets you solve it. And tomorrow on Main Street, COVID impacted us a lot of different ways. Learn how it turned into a publishing career for a recent college graduate. That is tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.